KGVM Bozeman. On the evening of April 17, 2025, the Hager Auditorium of the Museum of the Rockies was filled to overflowing with a crowd eager to hear Ambassadors Max Baucus and Michael McFaul discuss great power competition in the 21st century. The event was sponsored by the Max Baucus Institute as part of their Stockman Bank Speaker Series.
On a snow evening in Bozeman, we got almost as many people that showed up to AOC and Bernie in Missoula a couple days ago, so welcome. My name is Andrew Pearson. I'm the Executive Director of the Max Baucus Institute. I just wanted to welcome you to tonight's program, Great Power Competition in the 21st Century, featuring Ambassador Michael McFaul and Ambassador Max Baucus. If you're interested in learning more about the Max Baucus Institute and the work we're doing, visit us at baucusinstitute.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce Candace Strauss, the moderator of tonight's discussion. Candace is the Vice President of Marketing and Communications for the Montana Chamber of Commerce. She's held leadership roles in Big Sky, Sedona, and the Museum of the Rockies, where she drove record-breaking fundraising campaigns. And she's lived and worked in Athens, Barcelona, and Copenhagen. So Candace, take it away.
Thank you, Andrew. I would like to make everyone aware that KGVM is recording this evening so that people who aren't able to join us can still see the program, so just so that everyone is aware. Thank you for joining us for what promises to be an incredibly timely and thought-provoking conversation, the great power competition of the 21st century. We're honored to have two distinguished guests with us today, former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Mike McFaul, and former ambassador to China and former U.S. Senator for Montana, Max Baucus.
Both born in Montana.
Yes, I know. Trivia pursuit question if you can name the two cities. Anyone? Bueller? Glasgow, yes?
Glasgow's right for me, yeah.
And Max? Helena.
All right.
We go. Okay.
Helena.
These gentlemen need no introduction. However, I am going to give a brief one for each just because their backgrounds are so phenomenal. Dr. McFaul is a Montana native, as we just said, and one of America's leading voices on international affairs. A professor of international studies and political science, Dr. McFaul is the director and senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute of International Affairs and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, both at Stanford University. He served as U.S. Ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014, and previously was Special Assistant to President Obama and Senior Director for Russian and Eurasian Affairs at the National Security Council at the White House. A Rhodes Scholar and New York Times bestselling author, Dr. McFaul brings deep expertise on great power relations, particularly between the U.S., Russia, and China, and he is also a frequent international affairs analyst for NBC News. Ambassador Baucus is a statesman with deep roots in Montana as well and a distinguished legacy in both domestic and international policy. The longest serving U.S. senator in Montana's history, he represented this state for nearly four decades before serving as the U.S. ambassador to China from 2014 to 2017. During his tenure in the Senate, Ambassador Baucus chaired the powerful Senate Committee on Finance, where he was chief architect of the Affordable Care Act in advancing major free trade agreements, including congressional approval of permanent normal trade relations with China and its entrance into the World Trade Organization. A Stanford-trained attorney, Ambassador Baucus lives here in Bozeman with his wife, Melody Haynes, who is here with us today as well in the front row, where they run their consulting firm, the Baucus Group. Okay, so with that, we're going to just dive right in. So, first question. Ambassador McFaul, you have a new book coming out in October titled Autocrats versus Democrats, China, Russia, America, and the New Global Disorder. You argue that the threats we face today from authoritarian powers are fundamentally different than in the Cold War era. Please tell us what's changed, and are there lessons from the past that still apply?
Well, how many hours do I have to answer that question?
You have about 7 minutes.
Because I am teaching a course at it at Stanford for 12 weeks, just so you know. And I do not have any notes. But first of all, I just want to say thank you to the Baucus Institute. Thank you all for having me here. I get to come home to see my parents and my sister and my brother-in-law and Jake, who's, well, I don't, and everybody I got to see this morning. Tony, thanks for taking me to that event. It is a real honor to be here with you, Ambassador, Senator. You cannot remember, but the first time I ever went to Washington, I went as a Boys Nation delegate from Montana, my first trip across the Mississippi, by the way, and we met with you, and you were gracious, and I still have the photo, and sometimes I drag it out. If you follow me on Twitter or X, I sometimes post it. And then, of course, I got to host you when I was ambassador, when you came to help negotiate Russia's accession to the WTO. It's just such an honor and privilege to be here with you now. We also met in China from time to time, and I go to China a lot, in part to research this book. For those of you who don't know, Ambassador Baucus is an extremely popular person in China because, as one person said to me, you know, he was a real American. And that was not an insult to the people before you or after you. I realize we're being taped, so I need to be careful here. They're all great ambassadors. They're all great. They're all great. But you traveled a lot, and you're known to have done that. I think you went to every region, right? And anytime I mention that I know you, and I go to China quite a bit, I'm there in a couple of weeks, you made a fantastic impression, not just on the policy stuff, but for the United States of America. So I just want to thank you for doing that for our country in China. So now to your hard question. First, thanks for advertising my book. Already pre-order, coming out in October. And I'll come back if you invite me to give a proper book talk. I'm not going to try to do it all in 30 seconds right now. But the first thing I want to say is the main reason I wrote this book is these relationships with China and Russia, and I'll focus most on Russia and let the ambassador speak about China, but I'll have some things to say about China too, is an argument for complexity. And that's why the book's 600 pages long. But the main argument was I was disappointed with the debate we're having in our country, especially about China, but also about Russia. It got too oversimplified, right? It's the new Cold War. It's 2.0. We got to fight just like the old Cold War. And I'm old enough that I wrote my PhD about the Cold War and about that struggle. And the main argument of the book is this is complex. And don't oversimplify things, because when we oversimplified things in the Cold War, we made a lot of mistakes. So, second thing, there are parallels to the Cold War. Russia and China, I talk about both those countries in the book. They're both powerful countries. They're both autocratic countries. They both have international ambitions. That's like the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and we should acknowledge that there are those parallels. But there are third important differences, and to me, the differences are bigger than the similarities. With Russia, now I'm going to do what I just said you're not supposed to do, to grossly oversimplify, we underestimated the threat from Russia, and we've been overestimating the threat from China. Let me tell you what I mean, and then I'll say one other thing, the most important thing that's different, that's us. So with Russia, everybody, you know, Russia's Burkina Faso with a gas station or nuclear weapons. 30 years ago, the Soviet Union collapsed, and we thought, oh, they don't matter, right? That turned out not to be true. Russia is not as powerful as the United States and China by any stretch of the imagination. But as we've tragically learned in Georgia in 2008, in Syria in 2015, in Ukraine first in 2014, and most tragically in 2022, they have the power to do really nasty, awful things, what I would call barbaric things, and we underestimated that threat. Just because they don't have as much power as us or China, tragically, Mr. Putin, he's somebody I've known him since 1991, just so you know, we are not Facebook friends. He's not a favorite of mine, I'm not a favorite of his, and that's just fine. But we underestimated his intention, his drive to use the capacity that he had. And that, I think, is a difference what we got wrong about him. With the Chinese, and I do want to just say a few things, and then the ambassador who knows China a lot better than I do, I would just say we've overestimated, but in a complex way. Is China a greater economic challenger than the Soviet Union? Absolutely. That's obvious, right? But what doesn't flow from that, that oftentimes flows in the debate in Washington, is that means they're a bigger threat than the Soviet Union. They're an existential threat. Existential, I had to look it up not too long ago. I knew it, and then I forgot it. That means they're a threat to the very existence of the United States of America. And a lot of people where you used to work Senator Baucus, I'll say now, and a lot of people in this current administration, they talk in those terms. And I, to put it in social science terms, I do not see the data to support that hypothesis. I do not think that the Chinese are out to destroy the United States of America. I even don't think they're out to make the whole world communism. I just don't see the data for that. And compared to the Soviets, I see enough gray hair around here that some people remember the Cold War, but you may have forgotten, and I see younger people that don't know the Cold War. I want to remind you that it wasn't a Cold War. Millions of people died during the Cold War. And we fought proxy wars all over the planet. Korea, Vietnam, Angola, Mozambique, Hungary, Afghanistan. The Chinese, there are many threatening things they're doing. They are not engaged in that kind of ideological promotion through weapons and through soldiers the way that we did in the Cold War. And so I think we're going to make some mistakes like we did in the early part of the Cold War if we overestimate that threat. Last thing that's different. I could go on all night, but
no
I'm going to just say one more thing.
You're good.
The biggest difference right now, and let me tell you a little story about, you just announced the new name of my book. The old name of the book until 2 weeks ago was Autocrats versus Democrats, because I think that struggle is real. But it used to say China, Russia, and the New World Order, because I was assuming until our recent election that we, of course, were on the side of the Democrats, and we, of course, were on the side of order. My publisher made me change the title 2 weeks ago to add America and this word disorder, because another fundamental difference between the Cold War and now is the place of America in this struggle. Throughout the Cold War, I don't want to gloss over a lot of history. We supported some bad autocrats during the Cold War. We had our times in the late 60s, early 70s, where it looked like we were struggling in terms of the world and we were struggling at home. But compared to today, that is not true. And one of the chapters in my book, I talk about the mistakes in the Cold War, just so you know. I have a whole chapter on that. But I also have a chapter on the successes. And they are allies, free trade, our ideas, and American power. And if you think about that list, I'm a little worried about President Trump's commitment to that. Allies? We're picking fights with Canada? I grew up on the Canadian border. I got lots of friends. We got real threats to deal with. And instead, Canada, Denmark, we're picking fights with our allies. We didn't do that during the Cold War. Second, ideas. You know, it was an ideological struggle. It was a hard fought, and it wasn't always clear that our ideas were going to win. But at the end of the day, democracy is a better set of ideas than dictatorship or communism, and the rest of the world agreed with that. And we were in that fight through things like U.S. Agency for International Development, National Endowment for Democracy, Voice of America, and now we just gutted all that. And with President Trump, especially with respect to Russia, I'm not sure what side he's on. He seems to like the autocrat in Russia more than a lot of democracies, including the democratically elected president of Ukraine from time to time. And then third, trade. I'm not going to sit here with Senator Baucus and Ambassador Baucus talk about trade. I'm going to leave that for you. But I would just remind people that we set up a system after 45 where we anchored it. And yes, there were problems. And yes, there were distortions. And we needed to fix it. But we were the anchor of the free world, of the capitalist world. And that helped us win the Cold War. We now have a president that is withdrawing in ways that I don't think are international interests. And then finally, just on American power, I'm still optimistic about all this because I'm from Montana and that we're optimistic people. But even on the American power side, I'm a little bit worried, especially we're on a campus right now. I'm especially worried as somebody who also works at a campus. One of the great superpowers we had during the Cold War is we invested in research and development. We didn't have as many soldiers as the Soviets and the Chinese did, but we had smarter weapons, and we had better universities, and we attracted the best and the brightest from all over the planet, including China and Russia, by the way, and they then helped to make us the strongest, most prosperous country on Earth. And now we're screwing that up, too. So the biggest difference, yes, it's China, yes, it's Russia, but tragically, at least in the short run, I'm most worried about us. All right, now I'm done talking. The rest.
So, Ambassador Baucus, you were chairman of the Senate Finance Committee when Ambassador McFaul was confirmed as U.S. ambassador to Russia. 2 months after his confirmation, then presidential candidate Mitt Romney stated that Russia was without question our number one geopolitical foe, which at the time was widely viewed as a misstep, however, perhaps prophetic. Today, there seems to be a Washington consensus on China. Both parties seem eager to decouple the U.S. economy from China's, yet our economic systems remain closely intertwined. How do you think policymakers in Washington are misreading or misunderstanding the China challenge, and what aspects of the U.S.-China relationship are we getting right? And, in your view, what needs to shift moving forward?
Well, first I want to tell you about the book I'm writing. I teach a whole course on it. The problem today, in some respects, and there are many, one is groupthink. There's way too much groupthink in Washington. And a lot of pundits say, a lot of politicians say, it's just great. That's the one area that is United States worrying about China. That's the one area that's bipartisan. You hear it all the time. It's bipartisan. Everything else is partisan. This is bipartisan. Well, that's a problem. The problem is it's groupthink. And it's very easy to read what the other person's saying all the time and not have to think. Many times I talk to a U.S. senator and say, gee, is there anybody here who could stand up on the floor of the Senate and say something constructive about the relationship? Not critical of China, but just, you know, something constructive. The answer is no. There is no single senator who's willing to stand up on the floor of the Senate and say anything constructive about the relationship U.S. and China. Why? A, it's groupthink. B, they're scared to death of being criticized by hawks in the United States, and they think, therefore, they'll be primaried. Their strongest human instinct is to get reelected. They don't want to be primaried. So nobody dares, none of them dare say anything that's constructive, anything about China. That's groupthink. Second problem, and I think that leads to some of the real difficulties the United States, we all have with China, is that Washington, D.C. establishment for years, all except Mike here, does not know China. They don't understand China. They don't go to China. They have no sense of what China is. It's pretty hard to criticize somebody if you've never been there, never been in that person's shoes. There are many people in Washington who have lots of authority, the Senate and the House and so forth, very critical of China, who've never been to China, never been there. And my very strongly held view is that if more people in the United States, including the United States government, would spend a lot more quality time in China, not just checking the box, going to see this person, that person, that this relationship would be in a little bit better spot. When I was serving over there, I fancifully wish I could get a stretch 747 filled up with all members of Congress, fly them all around China for 3 or 4 weeks, and just go to all different provinces, eat stinky tofu, just feed all the rice, and then noodles. Each province has so, in northern provinces, they're so proud, each province thinks their noodles are better than the other province's noodles. We just get around China and just get a sense of it. It'd be very helpful. Basically, because we're all alike. The Chinese people and the American people are virtually the same. We have the same hopes and desires. What are they? Number one, incomes. Everybody wants a decent income. Chinese people do. American people do. They all want food on the table. They want to take care of their kids, good education for their kids. It's the same, both countries. Let me tell you, Chinese parents really care about education for their kids, more than do American parents. Address air and water pollution, be left alone, decent health care. We're alike. All around the world, not just U.S., China. So I just wish that it'd be better if we Americans were to keep an open mind and understand all this. What's happening? To some degree, and I'll pick up and basically agree with what Mike said, the rules of the road are changing. When I first started to serve in Beijing, the U.S. attitude was it's based on American exceptionalism, and we all agree that America is exceptional. But exceptionalism to force us to be naive. Mike talked about we didn't understand Putin. We were naive at that time. 10 years ago, we didn't really understand China. We Americans thought, the State Department thought, well, gee, if we just interact with China more and more, they're going to be more like us. they're going to tend to adopt our value system. Sure, they don't have independent judiciary, they don't have rule of law like we do, but you know, if we just interact all the time, they'll be more like us, and we can work together, we Americans and the Chinese. That was an incorrect assumption. Working with the Chinese did not make China more like us. Why? It's basically the history of our different countries. We're very proud of ourselves, our constitution, separation of powers, rule of law, independent judiciary, democracy, and so forth. They're proud of their system. Thousands of years of history. To some degree, the Chinese think civilization began in China. Thousands of years of history. They're very proud. They invented all these different inventions, and they're just very, very proud people. And it's sometimes overstated, but I think it's an important point. Chinese often talk about 200 years of humiliation. Prior to 200 years, they were high on the hog until the U.S., until foreigners had come in, Americans, Japanese, other people, and they humiliated China. Opium War, for example, there's lots of examples where China felt humiliated. And this now, a lot of Chinese feel, okay, that's 200 years. Now our time has come. They have bounce in their step. And they feel good about themselves now. They're back. They're going back to their rightful place in history. When I was over there, you could feel Xi Jinping starting to consolidate power. I won't go all the details. But back then, this is 2015, roughly, China came up with this Made in China 2025. Boy, they're going to develop so many resources developing the technologies of the future. That way they can avoid the so-called middle income trap where other countries just didn't focus on the new generation, new technologies. They rather just stayed with what they had before. And boy, they pursue that with a vengeance. 2025, Made in China 2025. You know all about how they dominate the world now in solar panels and wind power. They also dominate the world basically in electrical vehicles and battery technologies. And they're moving into AI with a vengeance. And you've read recently like companies like Alibaba and others are moving forward. DeepSeek really gave them lots of confidence. When DeepSeek developed AI at a fraction of the cost the AI has developed in the United States. Man, they thought, hey, this is what we do here. The Chinese today also see America weakening. They see the disarray in the United States. They see, hey, what's going on over there? A lot of Chinese who really like the United States, really care about the United States, are very disappointed. Very disappointed. The United States was a big shining beacon on the hill. What's happening over there? That's given them a little pause that, gee, maybe they're not as great as we thought they were. So maybe it's our time more has come. So we can proceed. And add to that, they're quite put out with what they or Trump's tariffs. China does not want a trade war. But Trump started a trade war. As you know, tariffs on Chinese products today, except for Apple products, is 145%. So it means any Chinese product coming to the United States today, if it holds up, it's going to be 145% higher than the current cost, which basically is a blockade. It's basically a blockade on Chinese products coming to the United States. China did not start that, but China is retaliating. They're retaliating because they're not going to be bullied by the United States. A seminal moment for me was at the beginning of the Biden administration when U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken met with Yang Jiechi, their top foreign policy guy in Alaska, and it was a terrible meeting. Each side criticized the other. Things have gone downhill ever since. But for me, I say seminal because that showed to me, hey, that's the first time China's really saying publicly, hey, we're just as good as they are. We don't have to do what they want us to do. So what's going to happen now, my judgment, is that if 145% increase in tariffs is maintained, it's going to cause disaster in the world. We'll see what happens. The big problem here is we don't know what's on President Trump's mind. Sometimes he thinks tariffs are great because it's a great revenue raiser so he could pay for the tax cuts. That's one reason he likes tariffs. Another time he could use it as leverage to bully a country into some non-economic result, maybe get the TikTok resolved, the Panama Canal, who knows what. And he's also trying to bully Japan and other countries get and say, we won't tariff your countries if you give us big investment in our country, help us and bring jobs back here at home. And the third reason he likes tariffs is because he just thinks, I think incorrectly, the more he imposes tariffs on countries around the world, it will not make America greater, those will not cause the new jobs to come back to America, as he thinks. One little point here, too, is pretty interesting. Of the tariffs of the products that come to the United States, about two-thirds are not consumer goods. They're components of goods. They're the things that make products. And that will be passed on in price increase to the products that are eventually made. My basic answer to your question is times have very much changed. China is, to some degree, changing the rules of the game by withdrawing from international organizations or infiltrating them. And because Trump is transactional, that's kind of their game, being transactional. And it's so the old rules, Bretton Woods rules, are just not quite as operable or valid today as they were then.
So I think Ambassador Baucus began to answer our next question, which really speaks about the shift from military strength into where geopolitical rivalries are really moving into markets and boardrooms and what that looks like as a battlefield as opposed to the traditional one. And so this next question was just if you had a crystal ball with all of the trade tensions and the tariff conversations and the roller coaster of our markets, what is your prediction with all of that?
I'll jump into it. I think things are going to go south if the more President Trump maintains these tariffs. I think things will not go as south if he backs down. Now, he's using these tariffs to get all kinds of deals all around the world. As he suggested to the Europeans, for example, hey, I'm not going to tariff you as much as I said I would if you do this for me and that, if you work against China. He is trying to get countries around the world to get together and gang up against China. Well, China's playing the same game. China's going all around the world. You know about the Belt and Road, China Development Bank, all they've done. So most weaker countries, by weaker, I mean almost any country but for China and the United States, is really getting squeezed. U.S. is pushing these countries and trying to use tariffs and it's a negotiating bargain to gang up against China. Work with us, America, against China. China's doing the same thing. You saw President Xi Jinping was just recently in Vietnam. He's taken a charming tour all around Southeast Asia. So they're saying the same thing. Work with us, and things will be better. These poor countries, they're in a tough spot. They got these two big gorillas putting pressure on them. It's not a love fest. It's not a hate fest either, but it's pressure. It's not love. I really worry that the United States does not really understand China, does not understand that China will not back down. Because of its history, many Chinese remember the Great Leap Forward, where tens of millions of people died of starvation. That's caused them to have a survivalist instinct. They remember the Cultural Revolution, which didn't turn out too well for China either. And they're proud. And there's a saying back of the Cultural Revolution is, eat bitter. I mean, tough it up. Eat bitter. It's kind of a little bit in the Chinese psychic and mentality. So they're not going to back down. They've been getting ready for a lot of this. China 2025 did not really begin in 2015. A lot of this is earlier. They're starting to think ahead. I just feel, in your question, the more the United States pursues the current policies that we've seen in the last couple of months, the worse relationship's going to get. And for not just the relationship, but also for the world. On the other hand, if somehow people say, hey, enough's enough here, and Trump backs down and cuts deals, and maybe who knows what they might be, then things will not be quite as bad.
So my mother-in-law, bless her soul, was from China, and they do not back down. And that is not a great strategy. I learned that the hard way. And that means my wife is half Chinese, too, just so everybody does their math. But I would just say three things. I don't think we're going to disagree on this piece. One, Trump is taking a bilateral bully strategy for friends and not just the Chinese. It's everybody, right? Everybody's this is his strategy.
Right.
And I've written about this academically, but I also published a piece. I'm on Substack if you want to follow me there. And I published a piece about a guy named Eddie. My mom's here. She remembers Eddie. I think she chased him out of our house with a broom one time. Eddie was a bully. This is when I lived in Butte. And I was a little guy. And Eddie, and he had two buddies. And we had a slang for them, and I put in the piece, and then my editors at Sanford said, you better not use that. Because we're being taped, I'm not going to tell you what I don't want to get in trouble. I'll tell you offline our slang for them. But they would bully the whole neighborhood, and they could because they were stronger than me, right? And in every transaction, if I had to do a transaction with Eddie, he won. And we can do that as the bully of the world. But there's two problems with it. Whenever you get stronger, you then push back. Nobody likes a bully, right? You have to deal with them, but nobody likes a bully. But now we got another problem that you just described. There's another great power out there that's offering an alternative game plan, an alternative security architecture, other things. It's not just Eddie, right? If you're just a hegemon bullying everybody, you're okay, but there's this alternative. That's the first problem to Trump's strategy. Second, there's an alternative to win-lose situations, everything's zero-sum, and that is agreement. And dare I say, I know it's really unfashionable these days to talk about things like the World Trade Organization, something you know a lot more about than I do, but there's an alternative way to renegotiate, to play by the rules of the road, which is through negotiation, not bullying. And I think we're going to win a lot of those bullying transactions, but we could win a whole lot more if we were doing it through this international rules-based system. And by the way, the Chinese are breaking a lot of rules in that system. But if we got together with the democratic rule of law countries, we would make everybody better off, and most certainly us. So that's the second point. The third point is this is all about punishing, in this case, the Chinese, but in other places, other countries. It's all about coercion. It's all about tripping them up, right? Denying them certain things. And that's got to be part of the strategy. Certain things we do not want to export to China, from my point of view. It's dangerous for our national security. And I agreed with that, with the Biden administration, things they did with that. But we're playing way too much game trying to trip the Chinese and way little time trying to run faster. I ran two-mile track at Butte and Bozeman, and my strategy was always to get ahead and to stay ahead, and we're not trying to stay ahead. Competition is good, folks. Like this notion that we just want to protect our industries with tariffs and we're going to be better, that's not a world, I think, in the long run that is good for us. So some tariffs are necessary. Some export controls are necessary. But if it's all about trying to stop our competitors rather than to try to make us run faster, 50 years from now, we're not going to be winning this race. So we got to run faster, not just try to trip our opponents.
When President Trump was elected, the first time I was living in Copenhagen, and it was Make America Great Again, number one. We're number one. And every European country lined up, we want to be your number two, and did these very nationalistic videos of their national pride, but they were running in line to be number two as a trade partner. So it's really fascinating to see from then and now what is happening. But let's move away from economics to diplomacy and global alignment. The chessboard shifted considerably in recent years. I think we've been touching on that, of who the players are. There's been talk of a reverse Kissinger approach, an attempt to pull Russia closer to the United States to counterbalance China's rise. From your respective vantage points, how realistic is this strategy, and what are the potential gains as well as risks that this poses?
This one's easy for me. In fact, I just wrote a piece about it in Foreign Affairs. I want to say two things about diplomacy on this one piece, but I want to make a broader point as well, because it's related to this big theme that you have developing, which I like a lot. So reverse Kissinger, just to remind people the basic facts, Kissinger, Henry, who I used to know well, and his boss, President Nixon. It's Nixon goes to China, and they pull the Chinese away from the Soviets. They orchestrated this split, and they were on our side. And now people say, that's what we should do with Russia to balance against them, because Russia is the most powerful player, right? That's the argument. And people in the Trump administration, they make this argument as part of their rapprochement, their engagement, their re-engagement with Putin. We're going to get Putin to join our team, and we're going to ally against the Communist Party of China. That's the argument. It's flawed in many ways, but just let me talk about two or three of the biggest ones. First, we need to study our history. So I just want to keep coming back to that. Education matters. And if you study the history of the Sino-Soviet split, you'll discover that the split happens before Henry went in a secret mission, before President Nixon went. It was alive and well before. They took advantage of it. There's no split between Putin and Xi Jinping now. So the permissive conditions for trying to run this play are just not there. Number two, Putin is, he has a play, which I think he's doing rather successfully, with the Trump administration and with especially this special advisor, Steve Witkoff, who has charmed him, to say, we want to be on your side, and you know that all has to do with Ukraine. But he has no intention whatsoever to abandon Xi Jinping to ally with us for a couple of simple reasons. One, Putin fears democracy. He doesn't fear autocracy. He fears democracies, and I've been in the room where he talks about it. He fears that, so we're going to be his long-term strategic adversary no matter who is president. Number two, he knows that President Trump, I hope he's right about this, is not going to be president forever. And so to make a play with this guy, even if he were not so as erratic as he is, he thinks there may be a different president farther down the road. And then finally, for us, what do we get out of it, folks? What are we going to get out of having Putin on our side? Leave aside the immorality of that. Like we want that guy on our team, the guy that bombs and kills innocent people in Ukraine every day. He kidnaps 20,000 Ukrainians. You want him on your team? I don't want him on my team. But even if you're just, you don't care about values, you don't care about those kind of things, you just care about geopolitics, they have nothing to offer us. Energy? We don't need energy. We got enough energy. Great deals? We've been there, done that. There's no great deals there, and they'll screw us again. There's no rule of law there. And this really absurd notion that if there's conflict over Taiwan, God forbid, that's something we have to put all of our energies to prevent. I was just in Taiwan 2 weeks ago, and that scares me more than any hot spot in the world. But the notion that somehow Russian soldiers are going to fight on our side against the Chinese over Taiwan, that is an absurd idea. And so there's nothing to be gained from flipping them over. I want to say one other thing about diplomacy, because this is another one of our greatest strengths, folks. This is where we are better than the Chinese. We are better than the Russians. And I don't know how you felt when you were ambassador, but there was no greater honor than to represent our country, to bring athletes, musicians, senators, we brought you, governors, even Republican governors, by the way. I was grateful to do that. This is one of our great strengths, that we have this soft power stuff that the Chinese don't have, that the Russians don't have. And that, tragically, the budget that allegedly has been submitted is calling for a 50% cut in the budget of the State Department. You want to talk about a great way to lose this great power competition? Diplomacy is our strong suit, and we need to play to it.
Thank you.
I just want to agree with Mike.
Okay.
No, basically.
I think he's a good guy.
Reverse Kissinger is a no-brainer. It's not going to happen. It is stupid.
Yeah.
It's never going to happen. Mike gave the reasons. I'll give another one. It's very clear to me that China loves to have Russia a thorn in America's side over there. Now, maybe Trump will do a deal with Putin. I don't know. But China loves to have Russia over there causing additional problems for the United States. And they kind of keep the United States less focused a bit on China. So it's very clear to me it's not going to happen.
So let's zoom out even more. This competition isn't just bilateral. It's playing out across global systems and institutions. What role, because we've brought some of these up already, do you see institutions like the United Nations, the World Trade Organization, or IMF playing in managing or failing to manage this new great power competition? Further, if we move toward a more fragmented global financial order with alternative trade or currency systems outside of U.S. influence, how might that affect everyday Montanans, especially working families and small businesses here at home?
I think that the international organizations are paper tigers. There's nothing there. They're not effective. They just aren't. UN is not very effective. WHO, IMF is better. The bank's better. But international organizations just don't have any enforcement power. Countries can go around them, do their own thing. And it's sad. It's tragic. But it's happened. It's happened, I think, to agree on right, partly because the world's changed. And a lot of it is of the internet, new technologies, social media. All that really undermines all institutions. Internet, social media undermines all institutions. even families, countries, churches, synagogues. It tends to undermine institutions because anybody has instant access to anything he or she wants to get information on and can disseminate and say whatever he or she wants to. And unfortunately, that's starting to shorten attention spans in America. It reduces critical thinking, not just America, worldwide. And we're getting siloed. We just listen to the person we like, agree with, and so on and so forth. It's a real, real problem. I wish it were not the case, but I think it is the case. One other point I want to make here, too, is about it's happening, I think, worldwide. A lot of countries just don't know they're inclined not to do a deal with Trump because they don't trust him. He might pull the rug out from under them, change his mind. So why would any country want to do a deal with this guy? He keeps changing his mind all the time. And that is really stifling energy. It causes uncertainty. It causes countries and companies to be a little more uncertain what they're going to do with the United States. And I worry that a lot of these countries, I'm thinking mostly about Asian countries, maybe flies anywhere, thinking, holy mackerel, we can't deal with this guy for another 3 years and 5 months. We can't wait. So we're going to start doing our own deals. Tectonic plates have shifted. And then we're going to look around Vietnam, Malaysia, South Africa. We're going to start putting our own deals together because America's not the arbiter of peace anymore. And we're not too wild about the Chinese either. We don't love the Chinese, but they give us money. And sometimes money trumps love, not always. It's not good. Another part, the thing about bullies. Bullies back down. If you stand up to a bully, pretty soon that bully will back down. But you got to stand up to him. One small example I think helped a little bit. I was serving back then. In 2015, there was a summit between President Xi Jinping and Barack Obama. It was in D.C. At that time, we were Americans worried about islands in the South China Sea. We were especially worried about China militarizing something called the Scarborough Shoal, which was just off the Philippines, because that was almost a bridge too far. I was back in D.C. for the summit, and the day before the summit, met with our Defense Secretary, Ash Carter. I was the only one there. All the usual suspects were there. Kurt Campbell, you name them all. And we talked about China. Nothing came in the meeting. Usually something doesn't come from those meetings. But anyway, I walked up to Ash Carter afterwards. I said, Ash, now don't take this the wrong way, but this is virtual war with China. What do you mean? I said, here's what we should do. President Obama should get in as small a room as possible, few people in the room as possible, look President Xi Jinping straight in the eye and say, you're not going there. You're not going to militarize Scarborough. If you do, it'll cause irreparable harm, damage. You'll rue the day you did this. And you got to make it stick. Ask, oh, that's a great idea. Let's go do that. Anyway, that's what Obama did. He was in the room, Susan Rice, our interpreter, Jim Brown, Xi Jinping, and their interpreter, and Yang Jiechi. And President Obama looked at the straight line and did just that, and they did not militarize Scarborough. Now, maybe they weren't going to anyway. My main point is, you got to stand up to bullies. You got to stand up. And I think the United States has to figure out, we've not done this, a long-term strategic policy toward China. Know what it is. We've been way too reactive, way too ad hoc. We don't really have a long-term strategic plan like we should. Figure out where our red lines are and say to China privately, not publicly, privately, you're not going there. And they have to know that we're going to back it up. We mean it, what we're saying. You're not going there. And if we were to pursue that kind of an approach, I think we'd make some headway with China. You got to stand up to them. Can't cross this red line. And that's it. China does not want to gain military advantage over any country. China does not have a history of military aggression. They don't. We do. We invaded Afghanistan, Iraq, South American countries. China hasn't. China, however, is a big economic power. They want to, if not win the economic war, they're going to use their economic power for influence and political influence around the world, especially in the South countries and in Southeast Asian countries. That's their play. It's economic power as much as possible. They gain advantage using that power.
There's a lot in your question, and a lot's already been answered. I just say a couple of orthogonal things to build on this conversation. So first, we may disagree a bit, although it's probably a perspective of time. So remember that all those acronyms that you said, right? United Nations, IMF, and we could add the bank, World Bank, later WTO comes on. That was all constructed at the end of World War II because that war was so horrific that our leaders, and the United States was the leader of this, said, we want to build a different structure so that we don't fight World War III. That's where the United Nations came from, right? That's where Bretton Woods, that you already mentioned, came from. And I think that was an admirable goal. And we set that out, and then some worked and some didn't. So the United Nations, turned out, it didn't work that well, right? It broke down pretty quick. Soviet Union, United States disagreed. UN Security Council did not keep peace around the world. That doesn't mean, however, that some of the norms of the United Nations were still not important in international politics, and every now and then they did some important things. There were two giant norms under the rubric of sovereignty that for most of, from 45 until just, I would say, until Putin invaded Ukraine, were fundamental towards things that made us better off than everybody in the system. So one was decolonization. People forget that, but it was an idea of sovereignty, and that turned out to be a good thing, right? Decolonization from the United Nations, huge achievement, we shouldn't forget it. The other was annexation. Maybe the first commandment was, thou shall not use nuclear weapons after 45, but maybe the second was, thou shall not annex the territory of thy neighbor. And there are some exceptions. There have been some places over the last 70 years where that has happened, but nothing like what we're seeing in Europe today. And what I worry about, if we just say, well, these norms don't matter, these institutions don't matter, then we're back to the 1930s, folks. And study that history, if you don't know it, not a great place to go back to. And it makes me even more worrisome because there is a giant isolationist tendency in this country. Mr. Trump is leading it, but he's got a lot of followers, and they're not all in the Republican Party, by the way. There is this notion that, you know, we got our own problems here in Bozeman. Why should we care about what happens over there? I understand that sentiment, but I worry about it because that's what the 30s were all about. Where did Make America Great Again come from? That's from the 1930s. And then, you know, the Italians invaded Ethiopia and people said, well, why do we care? Not a problem here in Bozeman. You know, we don't have a problem with where is Ethiopia anyway, right? I'm kind of paraphrasing what the president said about some countries in his recent State of the Union speech. And then, you know, the Japanese went into China and they said, well, that's not our problem. That's far away. And, you know, why do we care about that? And then Stalin and Hitler went into Poland, and millions of Americans said, not our problem. Far away, Poland, why do we care about that?
Senator Wheeler
was one of them. Yeah, he was one of them. The head of the Wheeler Institute is here. I spoke there last year. He was definitely one of them. And that's a good history to remember, by the way. Thank you for bringing that up. But we know how that ended, folks, right? It ended for us when we were tragically attacked, and had we had a different attitude in the early 30s, a lot of bloodshed could have been avoided. That's my view on the big piece. But the second piece is more important to me. There's a myth that's sometimes taught, not at Montana State, but at Stanford, that there was something called the liberal international order that was born in 1945. That's not true. It wasn't international. It wasn't always liberal, and it most certainly wasn't orderly. But what we did brilliantly after it broke down is we then said, okay, we can't unite the whole world. That's not achievable. But let's unite the free world. Let's build together the free world. And that's when NATO came along, right? So United Nations Security Council didn't work. NATO came along. Bretton Woods that you mentioned, the Soviets weren't in the WTO, or they weren't in the World Bank and the IMF and GATT and later the WTO, but that united the free world. And maybe a mistake we made is we expanded it too fast after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But the bringing together the free world was brilliant. And that's what we need to be doing more today. You know why? Because that's what the Chinese are doing with the autocratic world. Sure. So Shanghai Cooperation Organization, AIB, BRI, they got their own acronyms. And guess what? We're not invited in any of those groups, right? We're not a member. They did invite us to AIB, by the way. President Obama decided not to join. I think that was a mistake.
I did too.
But that is where we got to get back in the game. And the notion that we are going to prevail in this competition with the Chinese over decades. We're not talking about next 3 or 4 years. We're talking about decades by just going it alone. I don't think that's a wise strategy. So I think that's a good lesson from the Cold War we should get back to.
how is this new world disorder going to impact Montana? And you, as two gentlemen having been born and raised here, how did growing up in the Treasure State really form your views of the world and these major superpower competitors?
Glasgow or Helena? What do you... I don't know. I'll take a crack at it. You know, we're Montanans. It's a great advantage. We're so lucky to be Montanans. I mean, there's about one or two degrees of separation. Everybody knows somebody in our state. And that's changing a little bit with some of the folks coming into the Yellowstone Club. But, but still, it's a real advantage we have. You know, I come from a small town. Mike is a small town. We're all small towns, basically, in Montana. We know each other. We play high school sports together. He ran track. I played football. I mean, you know, it's who we are. And I think you learn that way that we're in this together. Also, we're an agricultural state to some degree. I think farmers and ranchers are a little bit more philosophical about life. I was raised on a ranch. They're more philosophical because they know they can't control everything. They can't control the price of the product. They can't control the price of the components. You know, the cost and all that. They're a little more philosophical compared with people who live in cities, 9 to 5. They got their salary. They think they control a lot more. But I think we in Montana, we tend to understand each other a little better, listen to each other more. And that was really a lesson for me, lesson for life, frankly. Again, I was raised on the ranch. Ranch hands I worked with, God, they're great guys. Frankly, this is kind of a confession. Well, I asked myself when I was age 28, what am I going to do the rest of my life? And I thought, gee, I want to get the public service. I want to represent people in our state. First, I asked myself, Max, what are you pretty good at? And I felt like I could relate to anybody at any level. The jocks, the intellectuals, anybody. I just like people that way. I'm trying to find that how to connect with people in a positive way. And that meant an awful lot to me. When I was over in China, I worked really hard, maybe addressing the point that Mike raised about attitudes over there when I was serving, really hard to try to connect with the Chinese people and with China. Not talk down, not be obsequious, but just at the same level because we're all in this together. At earlier meetings, and they're just 3 months roughly, I mean, meeting across the table with General Wan Hao, whoever it might be, and he'd be reading his talkers. And everybody on his side of the table have a copy of his talkers. My crack staff would give me my talkers, and everybody on my side had my talkers, and we were just talking past each other. It was too formal. So after a few months of this, I said, enough of this. So I would interrupt my interlocutor on the side of the table mid-sentence, ask a question, like, could you explain that, please? I don't quite understand that. And give an example of that, please. What's that all about? I'd do my best to try to ask constructive questions, not to be personal, critical, but ask constructive questions, how to lead us together to find some kind of accommodation here. Oh, they loved it. Now, they got off their talkers, but they said some of the same stuff, but still there's a lot more honest interaction than before. I'd have to train our cabinet secretaries. They came over to not be too nice, engage the Chinese, ask constructive questions. I found that Chinese like candor even more than do Americans. They really like candor. I think it's partly because there's more survivalists. They're trying to make a living even more than we are in our country. And I had to train, frankly, some CEOs the same way. Now, longtime CEOs like Apple and General Electric, they've been there forever. They know what to do. But other companies come over and I tell their CEOs, ask questions, engage. Once a bunch of them, the cream of the crop of our military came over, their one stars, Army, Navy, whatnot, and they're meeting with a Chinese military. And I said, don't just salute, ask questions, inquisitive questions, ask what's going on here. Really? Oh, yeah. Anyway, 2 days later, I met the top Chinese military guy, and I said, were my guys too tough on you? Oh, no, we loved it. They asked great questions. I just think in Montana, we learn how to relate to people, because we're all here together, and we love our state. It's something I like, I think, trying to be totally candid about this, that helped me relate to everything I've done as growing up here. My job in the Senate over there and certainly with the Chinese people. I did go to all the provinces that you mentioned, Mike. I loved it. I told President Xi Jinping I could go to all provinces. He's really happy about that. And Mel would give me a hard time. We'd go out to dinner someplace, and there'd be a table folks over there. And I just walk over and introduce myself, say, "Hi, what are you guys talking about?" And Mel keeps saying, "Max, you're not running for office." And I'd say, "Oh, yes, I am, because I want to connect with the Chinese people. It's that office in that way." So anyway, I think it's a Montana value.
Ambassador McFaul.
Well, I haven't lived as many decades as you have, Senator Baucus, in Montana, or represented the people of Montana, so I'm not an expert, so I'm going to just speak very personally, okay? First, I just want to say something about Bozeman Senior High and Montana State, but especially Bozeman Senior High. I moved my junior year of high school from Butte to Bozeman, and I wasn't that interested in the world back then. I want to be honest with you. I was more interested in sports, and I was a mediocre athlete. I peaked in ninth grade. I had a really great year in ninth grade. I was undefeated in the 2 mile in ninth grade, and it was all downhill after that. But we moved here, and I was just trying to find the easiest English credit. And I'm pretty sure some people here know her. I'm pretty sure it was Bridie Sullivan that told me debate class is the easiest way. Don't take Shakespeare, take debate class. It's the easier way to get your English credit for your junior year. So I took debate class. I was not much into academics back then. And I met this great guy, Bob Adams. And he was the high school debate coach. And that guy changed my life because he got me interested in thinking. He got me interested in data and hypothesis testing. And that's what you have to do as a debater. And I'm just so deeply grateful that I got the chance to meet this fantastic teacher at Bozeman Senior High. Without him, we would never have met. So that's the first thing I just want to say. I'm grateful to him. On the substance of what I later did, it also started my junior year at Bozeman Senior High, because the debate topic that year, and I was just in the class, and then he got me to join the team, right? And the debate topic that year was actually what we've been debating: how to improve U.S. trade policy. That was the topic in 1979-80. And our topic, my debate partner and I, was we were going to increase trade to the Soviet Union. And we had these arguments, and by the way, about getting more agricultural products from Montana to the Soviet Union. And that's when I first started to get interest in the world, and back then, the Soviet Union, now Russia. My debate partner, by the way, is a guy named Steve Daines. I don't know if you've heard of him. I'm glad you're hissing, because I'm going to tell you a story about Steve in a minute, because I just saw him today. That's how I got interested, and so I showed up at Stanford. I'd never been to California, freshman and 17-year-old kid, and I enrolled in How Nations Deal with Each Other. That's what we're talking about, Poli-Sci 35 at Stanford, and first-year Russian. And so that changed my life. Moving to Bozeman has had this giant impact on me, and I'm forever grateful to that. And I mentioned Montana State because I used to come hang out in this library as a junior in high school, and I fell in love with libraries. It sounds kind of nerdy, but we're nerd nation at Stanford, and I'm forever grateful to it. That's when I learned how to learn. Second thing I want to say about the big subject, and the last thing that I feel uncomfortable saying, because I'm not an expert on American politics, and I'm not an expert on politics here in Montana, but I'm just going to say an opinion that I have, okay? Second thing, though, is I just want to remind everybody, you are connected to the global economy. The inputs that Ambassador Baucus is talking about, such an important point. People always talk about the goods. They never talk about those goods. And I was at a presentation today. I think it was off the record, so I won't quote it. But, man, and you, those tariffs are directly impacting your small businesses here today. And if you think that we can live as an autarkic place where we're just going to trade with each other, that world, A, was no good. I lived in the Soviet Union. I know what it's like to live in a place that just consumes what they have themselves, and that means you stand in lines for an hour and a half to buy toilet paper. That is not a world I want to live in. And you think about it on Montana State, imagine you had to have your own economy here in the state of Montana and you couldn't trade with anybody else. You can't eat all your beef, folks. You can't do that. You need to trade. You need that global economy. It affects Montanans as much as it affects people where I live in the Silicon Valley. Maybe not as much, but you're part of the global economy whether you want to be or not. And I think we should take advantage of that rather than pretend we can go back to, you know, some world that does not exist anymore. But the last thing I wanted to say, because it's about Daines, and it's a different way of saying what you just said. One thing, by the way, I've worked in some pretty
places where there's a lot of pessimism, right? I've lived many years of my life in Moscow, not just when I was ambassador. Moscow is a kind of pessimistic Russian. They're, you know, read War and Peace. It's a pessimistic right. culture. They're pessimists, right? And sometimes I would be in these meetings with Russian friends, usually, and they're like, Mike, why are you so optimistic? There's war in the world. It's dark outside. It's snowing. And I'd say, well, I have no explanation other than I was born and raised in Montana. And I think that we are an optimistic people, and that's something I thank this place. And I thank my parents. I thank my dad moving here so that I could grow up here.
KGVM Bozeman.
But I want to talk about another thing that I feel when I'm here. And I'm not here that often. But I try to come here at least twice a year. What percentage of the vote do you think my boss, Barack Obama, got in the... You probably know, but the state of Montana. 30? Yeah, first 30, 20, 25, 40? 47%. And you need to know, Montanans, when I tell that story elsewhere, in fact, I don't think you'll mind that I'm going to say this. I had the great opportunity to give a talk, not unlike what we were doing, to the Golden State Warriors a few months ago, because Steve Kerr's a colleague, friend of mine. I'm a huge fan of Steve Kerr, and not just because we have a great basketball team. He's a super stellar guy. You should get him to come sometimes. Just impressive in so many ways. I asked that question, and Draymond Green, if you follow basketball, he said 15%. That's what the rest of the country thinks about your state, okay? And I ask it all the time. 20%, 22%, because the reputation you have, you guys are just, you're really, really red, and you're really, really MAGA, and Barack Obama, he's like, where's the black vote in Montana? Somebody said, and I said, there's not a lot of black vote here. And by the way, Barack Obama's a really competitive guy. I used to play basketball with him every now and again. He really wanted to win Montana. This is the first election, right? He was here for the July 4th, Butte, Montana. He went to the M&M bar. I mean, he was leaning in. He's a competitive guy. He wanted to beat John McCain here. And he fell short by 2 percentage points. And I tell you that story because I can't believe that this state, and you've all changed your preferences so radically in just a couple of election cycles. I can't believe that. I think there's too much money, there's too much the elites, our media is divided, our primary systems is broken. And so I actually think most Montanans are purple, they're not red and blue. And when I talk to Montanans, including people that voted for Donald Trump, I can spend a long time talking to them before we come to some disagreement. And I would say the same even about Senator Daines. Now, if the cameras are on, but that, to me, is we've got to start thinking about that because I don't think, and Californians are not as divided as our media makes them out to believe. I'm American first, and I'm Californian, maybe third, but I'm American really first. And the things that I work on, we have national interests. We do not have Republican, Democratic interests. And if we can't figure that out, we're going to be in trouble. And I really honestly believe that we're not as divided as the elites want us to believe. And I just tell you that story from Obama. And in my own personal interaction, I interact with a lot of Republicans all over the country. And I am struck when it comes to national security, we are not as divided as our elites want us to be.
Just one point. The question really, how does it affect Montana? Not well. First of all, the more these trade provisions go into effect, the more we Montanans are going to pay higher prices. No question about it, and products that we buy. It's going to adversely affect us and also people all around the country. Add to that, we're going to lose exports. Our export market in 2023 to China was 20% lower than it was the previous year. And if this 145% tariff lasts, forget it. China's going to retaliate. They're not going to buy our beef. They're not going to buy our products. Already, Australia is starting to fill in the gap and starting to ship their beef to China. Same thing, we don't have soybeans here, but my God, those poor farmers out in the Midwest, Illinois and Iowa, if China's not going to buy their soybeans, they'll buy from Brazil. And there's always a different way to get around something. Different countries can find ways to do things. And this, so the answer to your question is, the more this continues, the more it's going to hurt us. But going back to Mike's second point, we have a real advantage. We're a democracy. all of you are in charge. You're the employers. Our congressional delegation are the employees. They're just hired hands. And I had town meetings, I keep reminding people that I'm just the hired hand here. I'm just the employee. You're the employers. I work for you. I just encourage all of us to remember that. We have elections coming up. We have a midterm coming up next year. That's a real, more than an ace in the hole, that you have a real effect on our policy. For example, yesterday at the other institution over at UM, 75 people showed up to listen to ACO and Bernie Sanders. That's a lot of people. Those two tapped a vein, a real vein, and that's happening around the country. Don't kid yourselves thinking that the four in our delegation, they see that. They know that. There's not a tipping point yet, but pretty soon there's going to be a tipping point. And I think it's basically because we are a democracy. We could have those meetings like occurred over in Missoula and hear the, and I saw a long march here in Bozeman not too long ago up and down Main Street. That was cool. That was great against Trump. I have a lot of hope, but we've got to work together here. And my basic view is we're going to do all right as a country. The more Mike talked about, we take care of ourselves, do what's right, create jobs, education, the IRA, the Infrastructure Act, the CHIPS Act, all just do stuff, build our economy at home, and take care of our people, our decent health care, and so forth. And that's going to be very important in how we project ourselves worldwide. It's the old Pogo cartoon. Remember that? Myth the enemy, he is us. It's up to us. And the more we do it, the better we're going to be.
I just want to add one thing to that. I was talking about policy debates, right? Left, right. I actually think we're a pretty centrist country, and there's a lot of data to support that. I'm happy to send it to you if you're interested. McFall@stanford.edu. I'll send you the data. Those are important things. We got to debate about taxes. We got to debate about policy issues on a spectrum. But we can't have debates about the democratic rules of the game. I'm not up for that. I'm not interested in a debate about the Constitution. I always want to separate that out because, tragically, we are in a debate about the rules of the game of democracy.
Right, right.
And we've got to just fight for that. No, there's no gray on that. And I'm going to tell you two reasons why. One, if we become less democratic, or God forbid it breaks down, then it's over. My book is Autocrats versus Autocrats. We're all on the same side. But our biggest advantage with the Chinese and the Russians, and I would add the North, I would add all the autocrats in the world, is our ideas, folks. It is our superpower. And I travel all over the world. The small D Democrats of the world, whether they're elected officials in democracies or whether they're in exile from places that I used to live in Russia, right? They want us so badly. Without us, they have no chance. And to your point about the luxury that you have, the power you have to vote, I have friends, two of them in particular, Boris Nemtsov and Alexei Navalny. They were killed for the audacious belief that they should have the power that half of our citizens don't even bother to exercise. So remember that you do have that power. And if we're not there to defend it, then the Alexei Navalny's and his sons and daughters and the people fighting for it in China, in Iran, in North Korea, and in other parts of Europe have no chance. So democracy, it's you don't have to believe in the values of it. Just for our own long-term strategic interests, we have to remain a democracy. And the second reason, of course, I believe that and why I'm optimistic that we will win this fight is because I am a Montanan.
And so with that, can you turn the lights up, please? Because we're going to move to Q&A. Gentlemen, thank you for your insights. We're going to begin with the mayor of Bozeman over here, Terry Cunningham, with our first question.
Thank you, and I'd be remiss to not show appreciation for this magical moment, this rare opportunity right in Bozeman, Montana, to have the ex-ambassador to Russia, the ex-ambassador to China right here. And thank you to the Baucus Institute, to the Montana World Affairs Council, and to Stockman Bank for allowing us to have this opportunity. I wish it could be beamed to every town in Montana and every state in the nation. So thank you for being here. My question is, there's a current philosophy among our administration that perhaps we are overinvested in humanitarian aid, food aid, diplomacy, and security. That might create a vacuum in the future. My question is, that sort of next tier of nations, South Korea, Japan, Australia, Canada, Germany, do they have the capacity or the inclination to fill that vacuum that's being created? Or is this truly a vacuum that will be entered into as we abandon that by the other superpowers at play?
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty unique thing, right? Yeah. Think about Montana and ambassadors. Just so you know, Ambassador Senator Baucus, and my mom's here as my witness, I wanted to be a senator, but I never had that opportunity. Maybe it's not too late yet. Maybe I'll come back and run against Steve Daines. No, just kidding. That's a joke. And by the way, my other debate, he gets a lot of attention when I say that. My other high school debate partner when I was a senior is the provost at Yale. So Bozeman Senior High produces some pretty spectacular people. Yeah. The quick answer is this. They want to be with us and partner with us. They don't want to have to do it on their own. I'm a big fan of Winston Churchill. He said a lot of clever things. He made some mistakes too, but he said the only worst thing about going to war is going to war alone. We're better with allies. We're worse off without them. But I worry not about the autocrats coming in. I worry about anarchy. I worry that the whole thing just breaks down. That, to me, is one of the things that scare me the most. And I think about that interwar period that I talked about, right? You had those powers, and there was a lot of anarchy in Europe. There was a lot of weak states. That's what we want to avoid, in my thought. So it's the vacuum that's not filled that leads to anarchy that leads us all worse off.
My question is, we all know that the Chinese, the world, is running out of resources. I speak Chinese. I've done business in 90 countries. Care about their economics. Do you have any ideas on how to negotiate with the Chinese during this short 3 point whatever years, and then in 5 years to bring everyone together? We all need to come together. We're human. It's one planet.
It's love is life. It's mutual respect. The more we each respect each other, the more likely that's going to happen. That's not going to happen with the current president, our current president. So your question really assumes a normal president. We don't have that today. But if whoever the president is, he or she, were to go to President Xi Jinping privately and say, hey, let's work this out. Again, we're both in this world together. Let's figure out a way how to do this. I think it would go a long, long way. I may be wrong. I thought for the last couple, 3 years that pretty soon both sides are going to kind of fit. That was pre-Trump. Pretty soon, both sides are going to figure this out. That we really have to really work together. So my short answer is it's respect. The more we show respect to China, and also ask them, make sure they show respect to us, more likely we're going to work things out. Second, if they are a bit of a bully, to some degree, China will just keep on coming until they're checked, either checked internally or externally. We can't do much about the internal, but we can do something about the external. That's why I mentioned earlier, developing a longer-term strategic plan, know where red lines are, communicate them appropriately, and not bang them over the head, appropriately, privately at first, if that works, and stand up to them, and then they'll realize that they can't push us around. But it's mutual respect.
I'm not as pessimistic as you are about resources. I'm super optimistic about the long term. Super optimistic. The one resource I worry about that we're going to run out of is people. I live in the Silicon Valley at Stanford. There's innovations happening all the time. We're going to be fine in the long run as a country, and we're going to be fine in the long run as in the world if we do two things. I'd rather be on blue team than red team in terms of Russia and China versus us. They got a lot of problems compared to our problems as long as we do two things. One, we avoid war. What destroyed the 20th century was these catastrophic wars that made everybody worse off. We have to avoid war. I just came from Taiwan. I'm scared to death of that, and I'm scared to death that the war in Europe will go bigger. And two, we have to reinvest in making our economy stronger, and I want all our allies to do that the same. Why did we win the Cold War? At the end of the day, the American economy outperformed the Soviet economy. West Germany outperformed East Germany. South Korea outperformed North Korea. That's why we won. And I worry that we're not doing that today.
We got to get smarter. We got to invest in education and not just the universities, which of course I care a lot about, but K through 12 education. If we do that, if we invest in making us smarter, because the 21st century is going to win by who is smarter, not who has more copper or not who has more steel, right? That's the 20th century. I'd say copper because I grew up in Butte, Montana, right? That was important back then. But the 21st century is going to be won by who has the smarter people. And we have got to invest in that to keep competitive because, as you know better than anybody, Ambassador, that's where the Chinese are making investments. So we got to make investments in places like this as well.
Let's take a short-term question about what is your projection on Taiwan?
Short-term, publicly, if you look at all, you know, the presidents and the opposition parties, they're, of course, doing what you have to do as a small country that is a small place that needs us. They're saying everything's great. Secretary Hegseth was traveling in the region while I was out there, and there's this, we're going to work it all out. Privately, they're worried about the erratic part. You talked about our president earlier, that he's erratic, and what they need is stability in this relationship. But I think one of the brilliant successes of diplomacy combined with our military power and economic power is that we didn't have a war over Taiwan during the Cold War. And I think with smart diplomats and with prudent coercive diplomacy, I think we can avoid this as well. I don't think the Chinese want a big fight with us over that. And let's just be clear, even if we don't get involved militarily, we will all be worse off economically if there is a conflict over the island of Taiwan. But right now, it's the uncertainty when you give them no cameras and all the parties, not just the opposition parties, they're afraid of our uncertainty. And by the way, I would say there's a lot of other countries that share that view. They're just the uncertainty right now from the United States makes everyone nervous.
I don't worry much about Taiwan. Why is that? First, I will say that when I was serving over there, it was drilled into me by the Chinese that Taiwan is existential to the Chinese. It's a core issue. Taiwan is ours, the Chinese. It was drilled into me when I was serving over there. But I don't worry about it for several reasons. One, the Chinese are basically conservative. And Xi Jinping is basically conservative. He's worried about his economy, he's worried about his country, and he's worried about his job. Number one, he's worried more about that than anything else. If he makes a mistake, his job's in jeopardy. Others in the government, the Chinese Communist Party, will boot him out and get somebody to replace him. Second, he's watched what happened in Ukraine. Putin made a big mistake, thought he could just take Ukraine, didn't work out the way Putin thought. And, you know, Xi Jinping saw that. And he knows that the PLA is untested. It's a large army, but they're totally untested.
Right.
And as you know, in war, almost never goes according to plan. Usually something bad happens. It's unpredictable.
I learned that as a third grade basketball coach, by the way.
It's not going to happen. Most Taiwanese kind of like it the way it is. They don't want change very much. Trump is unpredictable. I don't think he may be unpredictable with respect to the Chinese. The only unpredictability I can think of would be trying to do a deal with President Xi on Taiwan, but I doubt that. Trump doesn't care about Taiwan, I don't think. Trump cares about bigger items. Yeah, I'd be wrong. I don't think that Xi Jinping is going to invade Taiwan. It's more a long-term game. You'll try to throttle Taiwan a little bit economically. It's lots of different ways. I urge you to read On China by Henry Kissinger. It's really a good book about China. He wrote about 10, 15 years ago. One of the main lessons of that book is that Chinese think it's the long game. He points out that Americans play chess. In chess, you win or lose, totally, unless it's a stalemate. Chinese don't play chess. Chinese play Wei Qi or Go. It's a long-term game. And basically, the goal is not to have to fight the battle. It's Sun Tzu in The Art of War. Chinese generals said, no. The way to win is not to try to win the battle, win the war. Just surround your enemies like a boa constrictor. Eventually, the outcome is inevitable. That's the approach they take. It's important to keep that in mind as we deal with the Chinese. So it's in Taiwan, they're going to take a long game, try to find a way to get control that way rather than invade.
Do you think that Trump will back down? And do you think the Congress and the courts will step up?
Members of Congress will stand up. They realize that their jobs are otherwise in jeopardy. They care more about their skin than they do about Trump's skin. So if things are starting to get pretty bad, facing re-election, they're going to stand up and start doing some things that they know they should do anyway, but it's taking them a long time to do it. Don't forget, you saw several Republicans vote to eliminate the tariffs on Canadian products coming to the United States. Several Republicans stood up, didn't pass, but you know, the little, they say in general, green shoots, things are starting to come up a little bit. It's happening. But on the second question, I'm very concerned, Mike alluded to it, the potential constitutional crisis we're facing in our country. Our Constitution, it's really a wonderful document, but there's one potential defect in our Constitution we're finding right now. What is it? When judges, let's say a judge were to hold someone in contempt, who enforces that? The executive branch. He has control over the Department of Justice. And we talk about independent judiciary, but when we have a president like this, that he's trying to change the judiciary so it's not as independent as we like it to be. I'm concerned. I do think, though, in the long term, by long I mean next 6, 7, 8, 10 months, the Supreme Court's going to stand up. I have faith in Chief Justice Roberts. He's going to find some way to find another justice on the court to do what's right here. I know what it is, how this will come up through the courts, but I do think that Justice Roberts is watching. He cares about his legacy. How is he going to be written up in history? He's going to want to do the right thing as much as he possibly can. I do think that there is some hope there.
Could I just add a coda to that, even though I'm not a senator? I teach a course on how democracies break down at Stanford. I teach a course on revolutions, too, by the way. And one thing I would say in the academic literature on how democracies break down, there's the formal institutions, which is central, right? And I agree with your analysis. And at your old alma mater, I was just at the Stanford Law School, we were talking exactly about what you just said. That is on the formal institutional part. But there's another element to this, and this gets back to something you said to our audience. There's formal institutions, and then there's informal norms and belief systems that undergird them. And the formal institutions get tested, and then we have to look below them. And if you think about breakdowns that are most popular, right? Weimar Germany is a classic example, but Russia in the 1990s broke down. What happened there, part of it was these formal institutions, but part of it was there was not a civic culture that was, A, very old. They were just a few decades old, right? Both Weimar Germany and Russia in the 1990s. And it wasn't very deep. It didn't go back far. They had these other illiberal, and I use the word illiberal with a small L, not a big L, cultural patterns. What makes me optimistic is we have a couple hundred years of a different civic culture. I took civics over at Bozeman Senior High. Everybody in this room, as long as it won't be gutted in the next 20 years, we've learned these things, and we have a society, and we saw it over in the university over at Missoula. I think it'll depend on the people, not just the Supreme Court, not just the courts, but the people that believe in these things.
Right.
But it won't happen if you don't take those actions, right? If you just sit on your hands and wait for somebody else to do it, that's when the autocrats, in my study of them around the world, that's what they take advantage of. The biggest thing that allowed those people to come to power is complacency and just thinking, well, there's nothing I can do. So I know that it's there. I know the culture is there, and I'm sure it's in this room. But then every now and then, you got to fight for those things. But I'm a Montana. I'm very optimistic that we're going to get through this period, and this our democracy will prevail.
You made the point I was going to make. Namely, I'm trying to be diplomatic here. It really is up to all of you. How many of you are going to do anything about it? You can complain, talk to your friends, read the papers and get upset, watch TV. Oh, it's terrible. Then what's next? That's the question. If you, in this room, were to maybe a small group, a subset, 5 or 6, agree on one point, some legislation, something's going through Congress. If you were to get on the phone and call each of the 4 members of our congressional delegation, mark it on your calendar every Tuesday, and call up and say, hi, I'm Max Baucus. I'm calling up. I'd like to speak to Senator Daines. Oh, I'm sorry, he's busy right now. No, I'm really serious. I'd like to talk to Senator Daines. I'd like him to call me back. Nothing happens. After three or four weeks of this, finally, they're going to realize, hey, that person's Max Baucus is serious. He keeps calling back. Maybe I should call him back. My main point is, if you were to get somewhat organized and get a little bit ticked off and do something about it, it's the old thing in life. Action is more important than words, but this would be the action. You call up. Look at folks, if you don't call, you only have yourselves to blame. If you do call, at least you've made the effort. You've tried. As we all know in life, we try our best in whatever it is we're pursuing. At least try our best. That's all we can do. Try our best. And if each of us here were to try his or her best to address some of these issues that we're talking about tonight, we do have an outlet, and the outlet is our delegation. They're there. That's what they're for. They ran to represent you. I know. It makes a difference.
So I apologize that I have to be the bearer of bad news that we're out of time. We'll have to invite you gentlemen back for a second talk and
this
question and answer. I will turn to you gentlemen and say you each have a final word.
One of my favorite expressions is, take advantage of your advantages. We have a huge advantage here as a thinly populated state. You have 40 times the voting power of a Californian.
And we know it. We're pissed off about it.
And influencing a United States senator. You are so powerful. That's a huge advantage. 40 times the power of a Californian. 40 times. Use it.
So I just want to say, when the snow started this morning or last night, I asked my sister, I said, you know, nobody's going to show up, because in California, at Stanford, if it rains, the turnout for our talks goes down by 50%. So I just want to say, this is a tremendous turnout despite the snow. Thank you for turning out. Thank you for being engaged. And we'll see you next time.
One more thing. Let's thank Mike for coming here.
Thank you.
You have just heard a recording of a conversation with Ambassadors Max Baucus and Michael McFaul discussing great power competition in the 21st century, sponsored by the Max Baucus Institute as part of their Stockman Bank Speaker Series. It was recorded on the evening of April 17, 2025, in the Hager Auditorium of the Museum of the Rockies. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on KGVM Bozeman. Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM, is entirely volunteer staffed, and we depend on the financial support of you, our listeners, to continue bringing you quality programming of, by, and for our community. We are grateful to those listeners, businesses, and organizations who have supported this station since we began broadcasting in 2018. However, we do need more of you to join them by going to kgvm.org and click on the Gold Support KGVM button at the top of the page. We thank you for listening and for your support.